You're listening to Smith Sabatino, Roland Smith, and Carl Sabatino. And Carl, you know, I on the internet each week as I prepare and we prepare for this particular broadcast, I listen and I watch and read a lot of individual blogs. Some are conservative, some are liberals, some are way off the mark. But it's fun.
Way out there somewhere.
Well, this one is more liberal, but it's something that I hadn't heard on the mainstream media. It comes from the nationofchange.org. And the headline is this: a startling admission by the Ferguson prosecutor could restart the case against Darren Wilson. Did you hear about that?
No, I did not.
See, I didn't think so. I don't know if this is true. I'm hoping that this is true because I don't want to spread something that isn't.
Okay.
But apparently on an interview for a radio station, KTRS, a couple of weeks ago, Ferguson prosecutor Bob McCullough admitted that he presented evidence that he knew to be false to the grand jury considering charges against Darren Wilson. In the interview with that radio station, McCullough said that he decided to present witnesses that were, quote, clearly not telling the truth, close quotes, to the grand jury. Specifically, McCullough acknowledged that he permitted a woman who was not clearly present when this occurred to testify as an eyewitness to the grand jury for several hours.
Oh, boy.
I mean, when I read that, I'm saying to myself, I'm not seeing this anywhere.
No,
What's going on?
I'm not. I think this is a big topic. Yeah. You know what? The situation in Ferguson and the situation in Staten Island, New York, and I believe they ought to be different. Unfortunately, the situation rendered the same for the individuals involved, but they are different situations. And there's so much confusion. So, I mean, that Ferguson situation was so confusing. You didn't know at one particular point, you didn't know who to believe. And this is mainstream news now, the business that you and I are in. I'm listening to some of these people. I'm saying, where the heck did they get that information?
I think we're tangential to the mainstream today. Frankly, what we're doing is comment, commentary, personal opinion. We are not presenting a news broadcast.
Correct.
Where everything is carefully structured.
Well, you and I would anticipate and would hope that it would be. Not that it would be separated into this, what I call never-never land of reporting the news. Because the story, some of the things I heard, and it doesn't matter from both sides, and obviously there was a political divide. Okay, even in the mainstream news, there was a political divide, and I'm saying, where do they get that information from? What's their corroborative? And they're just spotting this stuff out there as it was coming up, without double checking, without verifying sources, as you and I have spent our lifetime doing. Okay, some of that stuff was straight out of left field.
Well, of course it was, because everything has changed today. When I was doing it and you were doing it, you had to check every fact. And you tried to keep your personal opinion out of it. And if you didn't keep it out of it, the editor who took care of your script or your copy that you submitted made sure that you did.
That's correct. But it gets down to the facts. What are the facts of the story? Okay?
Indeed.
And corroborate them.
But today, as you just suggested, mainstream media has a political slant. I mean, each organization seems to have a political slant.
They seem to.
I mean... I listen to a number of them, as you do, and I am disappointed in most of them.
I am too. And I'm
not going to mention names.
I found myself turning to, and I will mention their name, BBC. I used to listen to the BBC around the world when I traveled a great deal, only because it was available and you can get it. Okay, BBC is everywhere. Shortwave radios, gosh knows, you can always get the BBC, particularly in the islands where I spent a great deal of my time. The point is that much of that news was never heard in America, never heard what was going on. This goes back some years now. I'm not just talking about today, that they had a different perspective on the world as they saw it, as opposed to American media. And I remember reading Edward R. Murrow, you mentioned him earlier, Edward R. Murrow's book, about that. And he states it very clearly. He says, we in America look at it from the 10,000-foot view, okay, in many respects. We look down on that news. We're not into that news. What changed that? Vietnam.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Vietnam changed. We were on the ground. We no longer could look up from 10,000 feet looking down.
You know, when I was over there covering people like you back in 1968,
mm-hmm.
I went over as a, I would say, a young journalist trying to understand what was going on over there. I came back as I tried to explain to some people as a dove with claws.
Ah. Interesting. That's interesting.
It was hard when I would then speak to various service organizations. I don't mean the military. I'm talking about like the Kiwanis Club and
sure.
the, you know, Rotary, where you share your experiences. I found it very difficult not to give an opinion because of what I experienced and what I saw.
Right. You were on the ground. You were in that madness because yeah. it was madness.
Oh.
In 68 in particular, and it got worse. In 68 in particular, that was the year that I had, where you and I had met in that brief moment or two. I was leaving and you were coming. And we knew what was coming, and that was Tet. We knew it. No one would listen to us. No one believed us. I've told this on the air before. But you were on the ground, and you and other journalists walked right into it. And we were living it. We were living it.
Well, you lived it, and we were just experiencing it
yes.
For the first time, or some of us for the first time. I was a first-timer in 68. There were other people there who had been there for years.
Years.
And knew what you already knew.
Yes. But no one was listening. I mean, I guess to my earlier point.
Well, the hierarchy wasn't listening.
No, the MACV was not listening, period. We were yelling and screaming and doing anything we could to get their attention and saying something's up, something's happening. And we, at one point, I remember us getting thrown out. We literally got thrown out. We were with a captain who was with us in our endeavors, and I cannot go into the detail even to this day, but in our efforts to let them know what was happening, they just tossed us out of the office and said, that can't be happening. Well, and in profane language, expletives deleted.
Sure.
It really was, because we're out there and we're living it, and you guys are missing the boat, and they would not believe us.
Do you think that we still, the military and those who report on the military, still suffer the same kind of disenchantment today?
No. I believe today it's a professional army. We were U.S., not R.A. That means regular army. We were mm-hmm. U.S. We were draftees. And we were just pointed to the door, okay? And all we could do at that point was say, yes, sir. But I will tell you, today they pay a great deal of attention to recon. They pay a great deal of attention. That's where the term boots on the ground came from. They listen to those boots on the ground today with great detail, because they realized with those men and women know what they're talking about because they're in front of it. That's the difference.
You know, even with the embedding of various journalists in platoons and other operations.
Correct.
During the first Gulf War, during the second Gulf War, and in other little skirmishes here and there. I forget where I was going with this.
Boots on the ground.
Yeah, but today, even with the embedment, there's still a distrust because, I think, of Vietnam. I'll give you a quick example. When, after Vietnam was over, and as a journalist in a major market, I often got invited to address the public information officers of one of our service corps. And I remember telling the story of my experiences in Vietnam and what went on and what I perceived it to be and how I thought we could improve. But a colonel in the audience stood up and very angrily pointed at me. He said, you, the media, will never be able to do to us what you did to us in Vietnam. He says, we now have plans. Well, by this time, a couple other officers got over there, took this guy and you know, told him to shut up.
Yes.
But that did happen.
Yes, because they did have plans. That was the embedding process. you're not allowed to freelance out there anymore to go see what's actually going on.
Well, you know, Walter Cronkite, whom you mentioned, always said, look, give us censorship, but give us access.
Absolutely.
That way you can have the story told chronically years later if you need to be.
Which is what they did in World War II.
Right.
But I think the Korean War, and we can talk about that, but we can go on this topic, and it is an interesting topic about our business when it comes to the theater of war. And interesting one it is. Well, let us continue on, Ronald, as you say.
I would hope. You want to take us out?
Yes, I do. Call Sabatino with Roland Smith on America Weekend, on the Envision Radio Networks as we continue on in our broadcast. Stay with us. America
Weekend. Order in the court.
This is Attorney Jay Coleman with The Final Verdict. Tony hired one of the top law firms in the state because he's the plaintiff in a very complex lawsuit. Each day, there are many witnesses testifying for both sides, but Tony is starting to think his lawyer is incompetent. The guy won't cross-examine any of the defense's witnesses. Don't you think that Tony's attorney should make an effort to expose the truth by cross-examining or at least discrediting witnesses? Stay tuned for The Final Verdict. Cross-examination will only help Tony's case if his lawyer can show a weakness in a witness's story. If he can't, it's better just to move on. Also, a common and useful strategy by attorneys is to decline cross-examination in order to suggest to the jury that what a witness has to say is just not very important. And that's the final verdict.
Think green. Harrison with you. An organization called ecobusiness.com has conducted extensive research over the past year to determine the real carbon footprint of flying in commercial aircraft. Turns out the way airlines have been calculating the numbers shows at best some serious fudging of numbers. The goal, of course, is carbon offsetting, in which we limit our carbon footprint in one area to offset a larger use in another. Air travel is considered the worst offender of all greenhouse gas-wise. Conclusive results for just a return flight from New York to L.A. range from 2 to 3 metric tons per passenger per flight. Ecobusiness's stated purpose for their analysis was to encourage carbon offset providers to increase the accuracy of their measurements, thereby enhancing the already wobbly credibility of the airline industry. More at ecobusinesslinks.com.
Think Green with Harrison at thinkgreenradio.com.